Now, I hope you remember that this morning I was trying, in the brief space of 50 minutes, to give you a basic introduction to Mahayana Buddhism, the kind of Buddhism that is found in China and Japan, and the kind of Buddhism of which Zen Buddhism in particular is a subsect. And we are rather particularly concerned with Zen, since it has had such a fundamental influence in the shaping of Japanese culture and the arts of Japan, and since we are, in the course of this informal tour, going to be visiting a good deal of Zen monasteries and seeing a great deal of Zen formed works of art, architecture.
This whole ferment going on, to get them to see this other point of view and realize that when you get rid of God, all you are doing is you're destroying an idol. And all idols must be destroyed respectfully. Not like those wretched Puritans who went around destroying all the saints' figures and the stained glass in the medieval churches. That was disrespectful iconoclasm. Respectful iconoclasm would be, for example, every Easter Sunday the Bible should be ceremoniously burned. Because if Jesus is truly risen from the dead, you don't need the Bible anymore. He's around. Available. You don't need the books. You burn it up ceremoniously with great respect. Because certainly God doesn't take himself seriously. If he did, I shudder to think what would happen.
That on the whole is depicted as being completely unsympathetic and alien to our existence. In other words, if you're reared with a 20th century, or shall we say an early 20th century common sense, which is based on the philosophy of science of the 19th century, with its rejection of Christianity and Judaism, you regard yourself as an accident, a biological accident, in a stupid...
Dad, didn't you know then, for certain, with utter clarity, that your whole life, past, present, and future, was somehow, as you yourself put it, part and parcel of that universal harmony which the Chinese call the Tao. I feel sometimes that phrases like universal harmony are so hackneyed, so almost slushy and sentimental, that it's terribly difficult to begin to find the right word for this kind of thing without sounding like Voltaire's Mr. Pangloss, without sort of jumping on this best of all possible worlds business. Because the thing isn't like that at all. It's very, very much stronger than the feeling that this is the best of all possible worlds. And the curious thing about it, it isn't that it glosses over anything, but it makes the most awful things seem that way too.
And so all these powers are projected upon the Zen master. He is a Buddha. He is a master of life. And if he is, the reason why he is that he has discovered the unreality of the whole problem. And so all these powers are projected upon the Zen master. He is a Buddha. He is a master of life. And if he is, the reason why he is that he has discovered the unreality of the whole problem. There is not life on the one hand and you on the other. It's all the same. But you see...
Now then, the other thing, first of all, that we have to go into is how does one sit in meditation? You can sit any way you want. You can sit in a chair, or you can sit like I'm sitting, which is the Japanese way of sitting, or you can sit in the lotus posture, which is more difficult, which is cross-legged, with the feet on the thighs, soles upwards. And the younger you start that
surface, which accumulated these things, and preserve them, and that's me. But you see, this superstition is related to a much more ancient superstition that the world consists of two elements, one of which is stuff and the other of which is form. This is a myth based on a model of the world which is fundamentally ceramic. God formed Adam out of the dust of the ground. And so there is a stuff, and so there are forms engraved in it or imposed on it or stamped on it like a seal is stamped on wax. What is stuff like apart from form? What is form like apart from stuff? All those problems which have bothered people for centuries are based on asking the question in the wrong way, on having used...
running continuously. Try it again, picking your own notes again once more. Now ask it to increase its volume.
Physical existence, or which really is physical existence, because in my philosophy there's no difference between the physical and the spiritual. These are absolutely out-of-date categories. It's all process. It isn't stuff on the one hand and form on the other. It's just, it is pattern. Life is pattern. It is a dance of energy. So I will never invoke spooky knowledge. That is to say that I've had a private revelation or that I have sensory vibrations going on a plane which you don't have. Everything is standing right out in the open. And it's just a question of how you look at it. So you do discover when you realize this, the most extraordinary thing to me that I never cease to be flabbergasted at whenever it happens to me. Some people will use a symbolism of the relationship of God to the universe, wherein God is, say, brilliant light, only somehow veiled,
through which the universe is looking at itself, exploring itself. And we're going to go into that much more deeply. So when you feel that you are a lonely put upon, isolated, little stranger confronting all this, see, you have an illusory feeling, because the truth is the reverse. You are. The whole works that there is, that always was and always has been, always will be. Only, just as my whole body has a little nerve end here, which is exploring and which contributes to the sense of touch, you are just such a little nerve end for everything that's going on. Just as the eyes serve the whole body and help it to find its way around, so you are, as it were, serving the whole universe. You're a cell in it. And it's exploring itself. So that you, as a function, you are a function of all that. And therefore, if this is so, it just doesn't fit these facts do not fit the way we feel. Because we feel it the other way around. I am a little lonely thing exploring all this universe and trying to get something out of it, do something with it. And I know I'm going to fail because I know I'm going to die one day. So we're all fundamentally depressed. And think up all these fantasies about what's going to happen by taking some sort of drug against all possible disease and pain. So therefore we say, now maybe there's another way around. Maybe that instead of solving these problems at the technical level, we could solve them at the psychological and spiritual level by so disciplining ourselves, by so doing something with ourselves, that we wouldn't be afraid of it anymore. And so, in accord with that motivation, we seek out spiritual teachers, psychological teachers, this, that, and the other. Could we somehow be made over so that we don't worry about the quaking mess by a spiritual discipline or whatever. And you see, if you examine that, that this wanting to overcome the quaking mess and not have it anymore, that precisely is the quaking mess. The thing that we object to about ourselves is precisely what we do about overcoming it. In other words, the activity that we employ in overcoming it is the mess that we object to. Do you see that? And it's very important to realize. And if you do realize it, you raise the question, then what can I do?
Boing. And that's fascinating. Boing. It's just boing. And that's all it is. See? Now, if you can really get with boing, see? You can see the whole universe in boing. Really.
because every vibration that's possible implies all the others. And so, likewise, with a candle flame, with a reflection, with grain in wood, anything can, from this child point of view, be completely fascinating. Not because it means anything, but just for what it is, that it is shaped so. It was a joke in part.
So actually, this shows your mind doesn't stick. Really. You can get the illusion of it sticking by, for example, cycling the same succession of thoughts over and over again. And that gives a sense of permanence in the same way as when you revolve a cigarette butt in the dark. You get the illusion of there being a solid circle, although there is only the single point of fire. And it is from this connecting of thoughts that we get the sensation that behind our thoughts there is a thinker who controls them and experiences them. Although the notion that there is a thinker is just one member in the stream of thoughts. For example, if you get a certain kind of rhythm that goes diggy 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 boop diggy 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 boop diggy 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 boop diggy 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 boop, the boop is part of the rhythm. But it can be used. Here is the point. If you believe, if you have certain propositions that you want to assert about the ultimate reality, or what Paul Tillich calls the ultimate ground of being, you're talking nonsense. Because you can't say something specific about everything. You see, supposing you wanted to say God has a shape. But if God is all that there is, then God doesn't have any outside, so he can't have a shape. You have to have an outside and space outside it to have a shape. So that's why the Hebrews, too, are against people making images of God. But nonetheless, Jews and Christians persistently make images of God. Not necessarily in pictures and statues.
Did absolutely fabulous work. And she could do everything with thread. Sewing, knitting, embroidery, make tapestries, repair tapestries. Oh, just fabulous work. So I've grown up in a background where thread is of enormous importance. She made her living this way for a while. So I was always amazed at the way, say, you take a ball of wool and with knitting needles, and suddenly it turns into a sweater. Fantastic. But I found out, you see, the secret of this, which is that it will do this, it will hold together by this combination of warp and woof. By this process where one thread goes under the other, omits the next, goes under the other, and then the next thing does the same thing but in the opposite way. Connect.
In the world of pure sound, can you actually hear anyone who is listening? Can you hear any difference between all these sounds on the one hand and yourself on the other?
Now, when you were thus absorbed in sound, where were you? This would be called a state of consciousness where we have a primitive form of samadhi. That is to say, we are happily absorbed in what we are doing, and we have forgotten about ourselves. You can't very well do that and worry. or think anything serious. And you'll notice that there's a special way of doing it. Because, I mean, we can go crazy and we can do kind of the wild Indian chants. But in this, you are sort of straining too much as a rule, see? If you keep it down to a soft thing like this and get a floating feeling of the voice, if you instantly you feel any sound is uncomfortable, avoid it. Slip down if you're going too high. Slip up if you're getting too low. If your voice tends to change, follow its change. So that you're just swinging along with it. This is the point of why, from ancient times, people discovered humming. And
because people can't be talked out of illusions. Well, now, there is another possibility, however. But this is more difficult to describe. Let's say we take as the basic supposition, which is the thing that one sees in the experience of Satori or awakening or whatever you want to call it, that this now moment in which I'm talking and you're listening is eternity. That although we have somehow conned ourselves into the notion that this moment is rather ordinary and that we may not feel very well and that we're sort of vaguely frustrated and worried and so on, and that it ought to be changed. This is it. So you don't need to do anything at all. But the difficulty about explaining that is that you mustn't try not to do anything. So the left-hand path is a very dangerous way of going about things because nobody approves of it. I was discussing this morning with my father that sometime in the distant past we had witnessed a comedy wherein the stage was set of a man asleep in bed in a highly Victorian bedroom with all kinds of fancy furniture and terrible stuff, you know. And the alarm clock goes off. And he wakes up in a total rage. He immediately picks up his shoe and smashes the alarm clock. He then gets out of bed in fury. He rips the sheets to pieces, overturns the bed, finds a hammer somewhere, and starts breaking up all the crockery, the windows, and until the place is a total demolition. Finally, there is left in one corner one of those enormous standard lamps, you know, with all the sort of gewgaws on it. And he,
archaeologist, likes to have his unit, a group, a society. And so it goes, it depends. Let's take rabbits. The way you describe a rabbit will depend on whether you are a hunter or a furrier. It's the way you look at it and the way you describe it, so that the way of describing always varies according to the use you want to make. So that the world is not unlike a Rorschach.
Pass your life seeing things through a dim haze. This is not exactly awakening. So then, that's a concern so much for the conduct side of Buddhism. We come then to the final parts of the Eightfold Path. There are two concluding steps, which are called, well, I explain the word samadhi, but I'll write it here again, smriti, samyak smriti, and samyak samadhi. Smriti means recollection. Memory, present-mindedness. Seems rather funny that the same word can mean recollection or memory and present-mindedness. But smriti is exactly what that wonderful old rascal Gurdjieff meant by self-awareness.
Here is a tree in the garden, and every summer it produces apples.
And we call it an apple tree. Because the tree apples. That's what it does. All right. Now here is a solar system inside a galaxy. And one of the peculiarities of this solar system is that at least on the planet Earth, the thing peoples. In just the same way that an apple tree apples. Now maybe 2 million years ago, somebody came from another galaxy in a flying saucer and had a look at this solar system, and they looked it over and shrugged their shoulders and said, just a bunch of rocks. And they went away. Later on, maybe 2 million years later, they came around and they looked at it again. And they said, excuse me, we thought it was a bunch of...
supposed to be fun. It's not something you do as a grim duty. The trouble with religion as we know it is that it is so mixed up with grim duties. We do it because it's good for you. It's a kind of self-punishment. Well, meditation, when correctly done, has nothing to do with all that. It's a kind of digging the present. It's a kind of grooving with the eternal now. And brings us...
He doesn't take it as meaning just plain old ordinary nothing, but the great void. And so he persists. And the teacher makes him persist until he gets way out on a limb. He has to persist so much that he practically dedicates his life, saying, just as the way Hueka symbolically cut off his arm. The student is put in the position of dedicating his life.
As defined, they're mutually exclusive. But when people fight each other, they are not good, they are not evil, they are people. And that is why wisdom in settling quarrels is always a matter of compromise. That's why a good Confucian always settles disputes out of court. Because somebody eventually says, oh, come off it. Look, we are both rascals.
And of the world. Would you like it? If you could have it? And so all these powers are projected upon the Zen master. He is a Buddha. He is a master of life. And if he is, the reason why he is that he has discovered the unreality of the whole problem.